Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents First Course by Jen Bouchard. Narrated by Caroline Keeler. Chapter 1. Vienna. The way too familiar opening bars of Billy Joel's Pressure pulsated from Cole's phone, telling him it was time to wake up. His lanky body, clad only in plaid boxers, showed no signs of stirring. Suppressing a groan, I reached over him to shut off the alarm, and I kicked my boss out of bed. He needed to get in the shower and get to work before I did. "You know that he's been on the phone pacing in his office for 20 minutes," Blair said to me as soon as I walked into my cubicle in our River North office about an hour later on that mid-June morning. He was sitting in my chair when I arrived, thumbing absentmindedly through papers on my desk. "Really?" I whispered, glancing over at Cole's windowed closed door and swatting Blair's hand off my stuff. Cole was the only person at Young Chicago with a door that closed. "How was he this morning?" asked Blair dramatically in a hushed voice. I raised an eyebrow at him and shrugged my shoulders, feigning a faux innocence. Blair always tried to magnify the forbidden soap opera quality of my relationship, and I tried not to play into it. "Come on, Janie," he continued. "I'm assuming that Mr. Emerson got that Northwestern travel mug from you, my love. Maybe you should add a UCLA one to your collection. Franny, the accountant, might be getting suspicious." "It's a local university. He could have gotten it from anyone." But he was right. In my bleary-eyed morning state, I hadn't even thought about the travel mug situation. Maybe Cole would like a mug from his alma mater for Christmas. I never knew quite what to get for him, as you can only buy so many live Billy Joel recordings. And then there was the age difference. Cole was 14 years older than me, and despite his relative immaturity, it was tough to figure out what to buy a guy in his late 30s with a trust fund. Nothing really impressed him. A travel mug might be nice. "Earth to Janie," said Blair. "You look tired. Late night alphabetizing Mr. Hollywood's Billy Joel CDs? People his age still listen to CDs, right?" he asked teasingly. He was lucky that I liked him so much. I looked back over at Cole's office. Cole was now sitting in a chair, gripping his forehead, still on the phone. Things were not looking good. "Okay, get out of my office. I need to write about these new tattoos that people are getting on their wrists. Apparently, this is all the rage around the city right now," I said, trying to distract myself with work. Blair chuckled. "Imagine what those are going to look like when these babes are 70 and their skin is wrinkled and saggy. No one is going to know that's a flower or a clover or whatever. It'll look like the grandkids got them with a Sharpie," he said, examining his own unadorned wrists. "God help me if the boys all start getting them too." "Ah, but that's why they will need to go to their dermatologists, who can either remove the tattoos or use the latest skin tightening or smoothing procedure. See, Blair, they need us to tell them where to go and what to do. We provide such a service." I winked at him with false optimism. From the looks of things in Cole's office, something was happening, and it wasn't good. "And we can then change our name to Old Chicago, which sounds way too much like old-style beer. And then your community won't want to read us anymore, which is like half of our readership. But I digress. Go get something done." I pushed him out of my cube and pretended to close my non-existent door behind him. I tried to push the feeling of dread out of my mind, knowing that Cole was in some sort of distress in his office. With a name like Young Chicago, it was probably doomed from the start. No one quite knew what the intended audience of the free print monthly magazine was, given its title. Office managers of pediatric practices assumed it was a periodical geared toward youthful families in the metropolitan area and ordered cases of it for their waiting rooms. They were subsequently not amused to find articles about the newest martini bars on Rush Street and the hottest places to meet singles in the Lakeview neighborhood. Conversely, the young adults who might enjoy these vodka-soaked articles weren't sure if young Chicago was actually meant for them. Needless to say, there were issues. As a complementary print publication, Young Chicago relied heavily on advertising for its survival. From my first day as a 21-year-old employee straight out of Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University until now, almost 2 years later, I was very happy not to have the responsibility of securing advertisers to keep our little engine that could afloat. In our relatively small office over the cubicle walls, I could feel the stress and frustration from my two coworkers, whose sole purpose was to sell blocks of space to tanning salons, bikini waxing estheticians, liquor stores, and whoever else might appeal to Chicago's under 35 crowd. It was a tough job, and it seemed to be getting more challenging as time went on. Despite the fact that I was worried about my boyfriend and boss, I tried to work. I talked to some tattoo artists, as well as a few women who had gotten the tattoos. My attempt to write the article was half-hearted and weak, as I knew something was wrong with Cole. So I surfed the web for funny clips of people yelling, "Baba Booey!" at PGA tournaments to send to my sister. My 30-year-old sister Alyssa lived in our hometown of Concord, Massachusetts, in a fairly buttoned-up existence with her husband and two children. She was tall, lean, classically beautiful with long brown hair and smooth, well-cared-for skin, and dressed almost exclusively in Lilly Pulitzer. She went to daily exercise classes such as hot power yoga and frequently organized teacher appreciation weeks. Howard Stern was her top secret guilty pleasure that she listened to in her car whenever she could sneak a few moments to herself. If the PTA moms knew who she really was, they would be horrified. I loved that she had a dark side. The day slowly ticked on. Blair and I went out to lunch, forgoing our usual takeout sandwich or salad options for a sit-down lunch at nearby Hub 51, complete with a round of stiff cocktails. If the ship was possibly going down, we would sink with slightly less pain. Cole still had not left his office, and occasionally we could hear shouts and the sound of his slammed phone from the other side of his office door. He had not texted me or emailed me any edits on the outline of the tattoo story that I had sent to him mid-morning, which was very much unlike him. By 3 o'clock, Blair was looking on career websites for anyone seeking freelance journalist work. People worked all around us in our open concept office, but as we approached the end of the day, tones became more hushed and fewer phones rang. There was a sinking feeling deep in my abdomen, and I don't think I was alone. These were journalists, and they had good instincts. When Cole emerged at 4:15 that afternoon and summoned everyone to gather outside his office door, no one seemed particularly surprised. We were ready for our sentencing. "Hi, everyone," he mustered, with his voice cracking slightly. He was a tall, fairly handsome guy, and I loved him. I could tell that he was upset, but was trying to stay strong for his employees, and I hated the distance that I had to maintain at that moment. "I'm sorry that I haven't been very available to you today, but I've had to deal with some challenging communications from our parent company, Midwest Monthlies. They were purchased by a larger corporation this morning named National Print and Digital, and they are scrapping anything that hasn't been profitable in the past year. As you know, we have struggled lately with finding our niche market and keeping our core advertisement base. This is no one's fault. We are in a tough business, as you are fully aware. You will all hear from the HR department at NPD in the next week as they work out severance and COBRA for your health care." He paused, looking out over all of us. This was the most serious and flustered I had ever seen him. Cole wasn't always the most mature, the most centered person. He had lived a fairly comfortable and spoiled existence, but at this moment, he noticeably felt the weight of the situation and the lives standing before him. "I am terribly sorry, you guys. I believed in us and what we were doing here. We had a really good run. If anyone needs a reference, give them my cell. I'll vouch for all of you." He sighed and shook his head, as if he was still in disbelief by what had transpired in just a few hours. "Now, we need to pack up our shit, and won't be able to get back into the building tomorrow. I'm going to see if maintenance has any empty boxes to help people haul crap out of here. Let me know if you need anything." He lowered his head and walked back into his office, keeping the door open this time. Like everyone around me, after we digested the confirmation of what we had begun to suspect that afternoon, I started to pack up my things. I had been at the magazine for over 2 years, starting as an intern during my senior year at Northwestern. As I gathered papers and knickknacks, folders and pictures, I realized that the laptop and iPad on my desk were no longer mine. I started backing files up on flash drives and on Dropbox, grappling with the awareness that I was not only unemployed, but I also had no technological devices beyond an outdated iPhone, and I would now have to pay for the data charges. Damn it. By 6 o'clock, the floor was haphazardly littered with discarded papers and food wrappers and cups, the evidence of once loyal foot soldiers who were frustrated with their new situation. Everyone was gone, except for me sitting at an empty desk with a laptop wiped clean and a blank iPad. My belongings were in 2 cardboard boxes and my backpack, ready to go to my apartment. And Cole, who was still sitting in his office, had been drowning out the sounds of his former employees packing with a stream of Billy Joel songs. For the past 20 minutes, though, Vienna, the song Cole always listened to when he was in an emotional funk, had played on repeat. It was time to intervene. "Hi," I said, looking at the weary guy sitting back in his desk chair, hands folded behind his head, eyes closed. His dark hair was rumpled, evidence of him running his hands through it all day in frustration. The graying at his temples was more apparent, as the 38-year-old boy who in many ways had not wanted to grow up very much had been forced to age in the last 10 hours. Cole opened his eyes, looked at me, and gave a small smile.
"What are you going to do now?" he asked.
"Okay, small talk. We were getting back to more normal Cole-Janie relations. I packed up everything into a couple of boxes in my backpack. I left the electronics on my desk. I think I will call an Uber and drop everything at my apartment. What do you want to do? Say, fuck it and book some last-minute outrageous dinner reservation? It doesn't matter who sees us together anymore. That's one bright spot." I tried to brighten my face with a hopeful grin, but it felt forced. He let out a small chuckle.
"No, I mean, next. Life. What's next for Janie?"
Billy Joel began singing Vienna again. It was definitely on a loop.
"Oh,
I hadn't gotten that far yet. How about after I drop off my stuff, we at least go get a drink and brainstorm? We can save the outrageous dinner for another time." Perhaps the answer was in the glass of some kind of craft cocktail. In all honesty, I had no idea what a 24-year-old with a journalism degree and experience at only one publication was supposed to do next. Cole had plenty of contacts and could likely help me. He stood up and started putting papers into his work bag.
"I've got a flight to LA tomorrow morning."
His mom lived in Los Angeles. I had only met her once briefly, as she wasn't interested in coming to Chicago to visit. Too cold and Midwestern for her, as she had stated. She was a semi-retired pop star who had one hit song in the 1980s called Hot Pink Love. The proceeds were enough that she didn't have to do much with her life to bring in steady income,
and Cole was set up with regular financial disbursements. From what he had told me, she spent her days sitting at her pool and occasionally socializing with other aging artists. She went by the name Royal E and was very tan and very thin. As a potential mother-in-law, she seemed terrifying. And it was always a bit of a relief when Cole didn't ask me to come along on the flight to the West Coast. The miserable couple of hours I had spent with her over dinner at the Ritz-Carlton in Lake Tahoe a few months earlier had been enough. "When are you coming back?" I thought it was a fair question, but I wasn't sure that I was going to like the answer. It turns out that my instincts were spot on. Cole drummed his fingers on the desk, not looking up.
"It's a one-way ticket."
He opened his arms up, and I climbed into his lap. It felt strange to act this way in his office, after hiding our situation from everyone around us for its tenure, but none of that mattered anymore. The magazine was done, and it looked like the relationship was as well. This felt like goodbye. I tried to squash every biting, sarcastic, snarky comment that was bubbling up in my brain and throat at the moment. Don't call him a mama's boy. Don't call him a trust fund baby. Don't tell him to grow up. Is this how I really see him?
"What will you do there?"
I asked, attempting to keep my voice steady. He sat up a bit straighter, forcing me to shift my seat on his knees.
"No idea. What are you going to do here?"
Point taken, but I guess I unrealistically expected more out of someone 14 years my senior.
"Anyway,
I guess I don't know either. We only get a month of severance, so it's not much time to figure things out."
Janie, you've got your life ahead of you. Don't just sit in your apartment making hors d'oeuvres for the next month.
There was a distinct possibility that I was going to do that. With cocktails. Aesthetically beautiful and delicious cocktails.
"You have so many talents, so many gifts. You need to share them with the world. Remember, Vienna waits for you."
I stared at him until he tapped on the framed autographed picture of Billy Joel that still sat on his desk. I got off his lap and stood up. I felt anger building. "Enough. I've never understood this. What is Vienna? Am I traveling to Europe? I don't think so. I have thousands of dollars in student loans from Northwestern to pay." He was trying to be metaphoric and poetic, but he spoke from a different place than I did. He had hot pink love money. Cole gave a huge grin, disregarding my response that had bordered on yelling. I wanted to punch him in the face.
"You'll find your Vienna. So will I. There's a big future out there for you, Janie. You're going to be great."
He closed his eyes, sat back again in his chair, and started singing along with Billy. It was over. I stormed out, ordered an Uber from my phone, and got the hell out of there. Almost a year of my life, and all I got was Vienna. I came home to Scarlett sitting on the couch, and Blair curled up on the oversized chair in the living room in a fetal position. He was clutching a Mike's Hard Lemonade like a baby bottle, and looked like he was in pain. Scarlett was wearing her glasses, and looked like the psychologist that she was in training to be. I put down my boxes and backpack. I think in the traditional office scenario, Scarlett would be sitting in the chair and Blair would be on the couch. We had mics in the fridge. Where did that come from? Blair sat up a bit.
"I brought my own. I didn't know how late you would be with Mr. Hollywood, and I wasn't going to wait for you to make me one of your creations. Sigmund Freud over here is an excellent therapist, but drinks aren't her specialty."
I went straight into the kitchen area and started pulling almost everything out of the refrigerator. "Mr. Hollywood is going to Hollywood. Or Malibu, to be exact. To Mommy. Scarlet grimaced.
Sigmund Freud it is.
Yikes, Janie. It's over? Scarlet had witnessed the entire evolution of our relationship, from him offering me an internship and hiring me 3 months later, to him seducing me through sending me very specific Billy Joel songs throughout the day for a week, veiled in his attempt to educate me in classic American rock. On the Friday that I received She's Got Away and Always a Woman, I texted him that I would be at a bar around the corner after work. He showed up, we drank beer, and he kissed me about 2 hours later. From that moment on, we spent almost every evening together. This was a major life change, and Scarlet knew it. I started chopping things. Garlic, onion, zucchini, olive oil sizzling in a pan, balsamic vinegar ready to reduce on the stovetop, sliced baguette toasting in the oven, prosciutto ready to julienne. Yeah, I think it is. He's going out there with no plans to return. He basically told me to figure out my future. Although for him, that means lying on a raft in his mom's pool. Is that my phone buzzing or one of yours? It was mine, with a text from my sister Alyssa. On way to Maine with girls. Just us. We'll call you tomorrow. Traffic sucks ass. I didn't know that she and my nieces were going up to our family house in Cape Elizabeth, but we hadn't talked in the past week either. I quickly responded. Catch up then. Lots here. Put headphones on girls so you can listen to Howard. She wrote back, done. I would dump all of my shit on her tomorrow. Maybe she or her husband Patrick had an idea as to what I should do with my life. Having a sister and brother-in-law who were 6 years older, and also incredibly smart, was very helpful when you needed help from someone with life experience and perspective. Once the ingredients for my impromptu crostini were prepared and everything was assembled on a white IKEA platter, I began pulling out the booze. Blair yelled over to me, "What are we drinking?" I opened the refrigerator looking for fruit. It was summer, after all, and found a hunk of watermelon. "Watermelon margaritas," I responded, and began to dissolve sugar in water for simple syrup. Scarlet asked, "How did we get so lucky to be your best friends?" And went back to consoling Blair. I muddled watermelon, squeezed lime juice, and poured tequila and Cointreau into proportions that seemed reasonable. It was cathartic to create food and drink that would taste good and be enjoyed. I joined Blair and Scarlet with my creations and handed them each an icy glass. Blair took a generous sip. "Oh my God, this is so fucking good." Scarlet nodded her head in agreement. I took another sip. "There's something a little off. Hold on." I went back into the kitchen area and cut 3 lime wedges. I rejoined my friends and squeezed a wedge into each drink and gave another taste. "There it is." Blair looked confused. "I thought you already put lime juice in these. Why did that make a difference?" This was one thing I knew about. One of my earliest cooking memories was watching my mother make a pasta salad, and just before serving it, she squeezed a small lemon wedge over the entire dish. I learned all about the benefits of acid at the end in cooking that day, and I later discovered that it works for cocktails too. It's a little trick that brings out the flavors in the drink. You can thank Corinne for that one. Scarlet gave a small clap. All hail Mama Whitman. Things we learn from her, like the merits of making your own Bloody Mary, I'll never buy them pre-mixed again. It was true. My mom made a killer Bloody Mary. "Janie," she said, shifting the conversation. "I'm so sorry. He's an idiot. He's going to realize quickly what a mistake he made." Blair nodded vehemently. "He's so in his head over the magazine that he's probably not thinking clearly. I bet he calls tomorrow." I wasn't so sure, but it was comforting just to sit with my friends, devouring the crostini and the margaritas. Scarlett was supposed to meet up with the guy she had just started seeing and was finalizing plans to join him at bar trivia. Blair was contemplating his options for the evening, and since he wasn't dating anyone at the moment, it was either going to be finding an impromptu date via an iPhone app or sitting with me and whatever else I threw together in the kitchen. My bet was on losing out to a muscular guy in Andersonville, although I am sure I made a better spinach dip. My phone started buzzing, but this time it was an actual phone call. Cole? Maybe he had second thoughts and wanted to see me before leaving? No, it was my sister. Alyssa? Janie! She was gasping and crying so hard she could barely say my name. What is it? What's wrong? I wasn't used to ever hearing her like this. My sister was the most settled and stable person I knew. And we Whitmans just weren't criers. Something very bad had happened.
You need to get here. The plane they borrowed. I don't know how. I can't believe it. Not them. You need to be here. Please get here.
Her voice was desperate and urgent and painful to hear.
Okay, as fast as I can,
I squeaked out. I hung up. I didn't know what else to say. Scarlett was staring at me.
What's going on? That didn't sound good.
I looked around the room at the apartment. It was spinning slightly. I saw the platter of crumbs where Christini had sat. I saw glasses with half-melted ice cubes. I saw a small framed picture of Cole and me on the counter, his hands on my shoulders, both of us laughing. I cleared my throat and refocused on Scarlett and Blair, who were now sitting next to each other with concerned expressions on their faces. I had to say something.
I think my parents just crashed a plane.
Chapter 2. Anvil.
A beautiful Whitman girl lying in a hammock.
I groaned silently to myself as I felt Lance Ashton standing above me. Lance was the summer neighbor of my youth, my temporary romance for many of those years, and someone who once made my heart beat so loudly in my chest that I swore he could hear it from across the room. 6 years had passed since the last time I had kissed him, and that was totally fine with me. I blinked my eyes open and managed a half-smile at Lance. His grin was enormous as he stood in front of me, sweating through his too-tight Vineyard Vines t-shirt. Just shy of 6 feet tall, Lance had been a fairly cute teenager. Or at least I had thought so. Since college, he had gained roughly 30 pounds, stopped shaving every day, and didn't get regular haircuts. Needless to say, I hadn't felt an attraction to him in a long time.
Hey there. Do you need anything?
I asked him. Was that rude? I wasn't really trying to be awful, but the last 2 weeks had taken a toll on me. Things had been even harder on my sister Alyssa, who was sitting about 10 feet away from me in an Adirondack chair, wearing oversized sunglasses, taking sips out of a very large glass of Chardonnay, while pretending to watch her daughters play in the yard. I may have lost my job and my boyfriend, but Alyssa's marriage was on the verge of collapse. Looming over all of this heartache was the loss of our parents, which almost made the other problems seem small. But they weren't, especially not for Alyssa. After I arrived in Maine on the last flight to Boston the night that everything had happened, Alyssa and I spent many hours dealing with the aftermath of the plane crash, as well as her own personal hell. At that point, she had not even called Patrick yet to tell him about the crash. Everything was just still too raw for her. The day had started fairly normally for Alyssa, she told me. As it was the beginning of summer, she had her two daughters, Trish and Susie, enrolled in an art program for the morning. She dropped them off and drove to her usual hot yoga class in the center of our hometown of Concord, Massachusetts. She went into the studio and set up her mat and arranged her towel and water bottle alongside it.
the usual cast of characters was present, and many of them were Alyssa's friends. She saw Kathy walk into the room and gave her a wave. They were regulars in the class, and their older daughters were in preschool together.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?